Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Little Bee by Chris Cleave tells the story of a teenage Nigerian girl's attempt to escape from the men who massacred her village. Oil politics and ethnic warfare simmer in the background of the narrative. When the title character, Little Bee, meets an educated white couple on a Nigerian beach, it changes the course of all their lives. Both heart-wrenching and hopeful, the novel explores what people are willing to do or not do to save others and themselves. Joining me in the studio for this month's Reader's Review, Nigerian-American journalist Dayo Olapade, Joel Charney of Refugees International, and creative writing instructor Lisa Page. We do invite you to join us. This book was so highly recommended to us. I hope you've read it, but if you have not, join us with your questions, comments. In any case, 800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu, or join us on Facebook or tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dayo, tell me how you reacted to the book, Little Bee.
Well, I think the book is an incredibly strong piece of journalism, which is, of course, my profession. And it's about trying to tell a story in a way that gives the most impact and the most weight to the political and cultural issues that surround it. And it's a remarkable achievement in that it does so. It dances around the complicated politics of Nigerian oil production and immigration policy in England. And it does so through the lens of two really well-drawn characters who pass the narrative back and forth between them chapter to chapter, which I thought was a really wonderful device and underscored the way that these two women have become connected and are sharing the same story, trying to tell the same story in a way that has the most impact for the reader.
There's a significant age difference between the two women.
Yes, and I thought that that was The conversations that go on between Little Bee and the other protagonist, whose name is Sarah, who works as a journalist in England, were very very serious, I thought. I thought that the two women related to one another sometimes at Little Bee's level, and she's, you know, a very precocious 16-year-old, and sometimes at the register of a 30-something woman who has had a lot of life behind her. And I enjoyed that seeing the two of them interact as equals in many respects.
Lisa Page, how did you react?
Well, you know, what really strikes me about these two narrators is that they're both women. They're women responding to this international story. Disaster, war, power, violence, and what happens to women as opposed to men on the battlefield. And that choice in terms of the narrative was outstanding to me. It drove the story in a way that made it a complete page-turner.
Because, as you say, what happens to women in this story is clearly violence by rape, by torture, by the worst possible kind of treatment.
And women are vulnerable because of their children, because of their families. That comes through throughout the novel.
Joel Charney, as a representative of Refugees International, there's a fair amount in this story, certainly starting off when Little Bee is freed from a refugee center in Great Britain to her being able to connect with these people she's met on a beach. What was your reaction from that refugee point of view?
My reaction was it really brought home how resourceful refugees are. I mean, there's a tendency to see refugees as victims, and, you know, sometimes our organizations, humanitarian organizations, collectively kind of play into that dynamic. But you know, the opening I thought was really beautiful and really powerful. I mean, the idea that here's this girl, 16 years old, she's somehow gets miraculously released from the detention facility.
Miraculously is quite a word there.
She literally has no money, and she's clutching on to, what was it? It was a driver's license, right?
A driver's license she found on the beach.
That's right.
Plus a single pair of underwear.
So the idea that with that level of resources, you know, she kind of can make it, find the family. The idea that she spent her entire time in detention, as she put it, learning the Queen's English in preparation for being able to function in society. I mean, all that really rang true for me.
Let's talk about that incident on the beach, because it seems to me that that's the key to the entire narrative, though obviously it takes in a great deal more. Dio, as this young girl, Little B, and her sister, her older sister by 2 years, are walking on this Nigerian beach, a British couple have foolishly decided to take their vacation there, and they meet, just as soldiers, Nigerian soldiers, encounter all four. What happens?
Well, it's really heartbreaking. It's this clash of civilizations. This British couple is on vacation, so they think, and the narrator Sarah describes the incongruousness of wearing a little green Hermes bikini as the scene of horror is unfolding. The men are chasing the two girls, Little B and her sister. They come across Sarah and Andrew, the British couple, and to save their lives, they ask for a finger.
From
one of the two British individuals in the situation. And the theme of sacrifice and what you will do for other people is constant throughout the book. And this is the turning point at which, and this is dead center in the middle of the book, where it becomes a question of what will you give up in order to save a stranger's life? And they're strangers. They've just met through circumstance, through globalization, whatever you want to call it. Sarah gives it up. Sarah gives up. She sacrifices her finger for the two girls. As it turns out, one of the daughters is killed anyway. And Little B is sort of left there. You know, she survives, but they are separated. They go back to their worlds, and this incident is the meat of both the thematic content of the book and the sort of the plot, which is what happens when in the aftermath of the sacrifice.
And of course, Little B and her sister have actually escaped from their village, which has been totally wiped out and burned to the ground.
And they've witnessed their parents being murdered. It's all because of the oil fields and the warriors going in and cleaning out this spot. And I just wanted to say, too, that the husband, Sarah's husband, Andrew, was asked to sacrifice his finger first.
Right.
And he did not do it. And so only one of the girls lives.
Right.
And he suffers profoundly as a result of that.
Yeah, I thought that was a key point, just the fact that Sarah's sacrifice, she knew, was only going to save one of them at that point. The leader of the group had already made that clear, so she was willing to make that sacrifice, but at the same time, even at that moment, there was the burden of knowing that one of the sisters was going to be killed.
How does Little B get out of that situation? We don't really know. Where does she go? How does she manage to escape that beach when the soldiers have taken her sister and killed her.
Well, I think providing some context for this is very helpful in terms of the political situation in Nigeria. You know, Little B, and the thing that I noticed about this book was how contemporary it felt. And there's a sense that, you know, the sort of war-torn memory or idea of African nations is in the past, but the warring in the Niger Delta has been ongoing probably since the inception of the modern Nigerian state, but increasingly in the last 5 to 10 years has become a flashpoint of international concern where oil companies, it's not even really clear who the good guys and the bad guys are. Oil companies are in the Niger Delta. They're polluting the environment. They're making a lot of money. The Nigerian government in some ways is complicit in this arrangement. And what you forget and what this book reminds us is that there are people who are living there who are, and I think Little B is fleeing from having witnessed the oil company do some sort of wrong in her village. And so there are mercenaries who act on behalf of the oil companies, who act on behalf of the Nigerian state. And it's all very complicated, but at the heart of it is that these people are not secure. These people are not safe. And so naturally, she and her sister go on the run, having seen their families murdered. And I think it's that she gets on a boat. She gets on a boat on the shore, she stows away, and she wakes up in England. And then that portion of the story unfolds.
Diolabade. And Joel Charney, Lisa Page, we're all talking about Little B, a novel by Chris Cleave that was a New York Times bestseller. I hope you'll join us. Welcome back to this month's Reader's Review. We're talking about British author Chris Cleave's book. It's titled Little B. And Joel Charney, I know that Chris Cleave worked for several days at a detention center for asylum seekers in England. How realistic do you think his depiction is of the detention center?
Well, I have to assume that it's realistic, but I think what's interesting is that, and I'd be interested in the comment of others as to why he made this choice, but he didn't really focus on conditions. In other words, there was never a narrative that was lengthy about the detention center itself. That was kind of elided. But the one detail that struck me that was powerful was this idea that women at the center basically get sanitary supplies one at a time. And that whole idea of humiliation that's sort of so degrading, the idea that, you know, it's just each tampon or, you know, a napkin is issued one at a time. Again, just put yourself in the situation of women in the center. I mean, that really struck me.
Is there not also the sense that the reason that Yvette and Little B and one other person are released is because Yvette sacrifices her own body to the guard in charge, Lisa.
Yeah, and she's rather cavalier about it. You know, I took care of him, so he took care of me. And these other women are allowed to leave because she would look too obvious leaving by herself. The guard is sort of Yvette, so the guard is sort of covering for himself by letting other women go with her.
But I mean, to say that, I mean, it's impossible to say whether, you know, that dynamic to the level of, you know, having, you know, to trade sex for relief. I mean, release. I think what Cleave is basically saying is it's not that happens in every detention center, but again, it's kind of a symbol of the humiliation that the asylum seekers are subjected to.
Dio, just before the break, we were talking about the oil politics and what had happened in Little Bee's village, presumably because of that oil. I know you wanted to read a portion of the book for us.
Right. Well, this is a section where Little Bee, who, again, is hyper-literate, I think, which is a really interesting device in this story. She is someone who has spent her time in the detention center, again, as resourcefully as she can, equipping herself to participate in Britain. And there's a whole literary tradition that surrounds equipping yourself to live in a new country. She succeeds admirably. And so she's got this very precocious voice, and she's making sense of what is going on in a sort of a very clear way. And she's talking about oil here. A country's future is found in its natural resources. It is my country's biggest export. It leaves so quickly through our seaports. The girls from my village could never even see it, and they could not know what it looked like. Actually, the future looks like gasoline. I discovered this when I was reading the newspapers in the detention center, and finally I made sense of what had happened to me back home. What had happened was the oil companies had discovered a huge reserve of the future underneath my village. To be precise, what they discovered was crude oil, which is the future before it has been refined. It is like a dream of the future, really, and like any dream, it ends with a rude awakening. So Little Bee is putting together the pieces of what has happened to her, because from the ground, you know, she'd never seen, she comes to London, she sees cars, she sees trains, she sees people, that's all unfamiliar to her. What she didn't understand was why the oil had caused her this trauma. And she's putting it together on the way to the gas station, where Sarah's filling up the car with gas, and she wonders, maybe this is why they don't let us see gasoline. Because you can't see it. You pump it straight into the car. And it's a way of sort of masking the realities of what it takes to get it and make money from it and who is gets the short end of the stick.
Certainly brings us to present day America, doesn't it,
Well,
Lisa?
Sure. What's happening in Louisiana? What's happening? I mean, the whole oil spill is right there, and what's happened to those people in that area. But I just wanted to piggyback a little bit on your reading, because one of the strengths to this in this novel is that Little Bee is also compared with Sarah. Sarah is this London magazine editor and journalist who her problems are that she's in an extramarital affair and her husband has committed suicide, and her problems pale because of what she sees in Little Bee. She's been so self-absorbed. She carries on about her magazine and how it's doing a new feature on having an affair with your boss. And it's so trite compared to this larger
she
story.
She finally comes to realize
yes.
that. And when she does, she realizes she's got to get out of the magazine and then try to begin to write about the refugee problem, Joel.
That's right. So it's sort of through Little Bee she achieves this epiphany that's where you get into the way the world is connected, and Sarah is forced to engage. You know, she lost a finger on the beach, and that provoked a further crisis. But she still, at that point, wasn't really thinking, in essence, about the political crisis that Little Bee's life presents. So the political decision that she makes at the end of the book is the obviously the direct result of her interaction. And I mean, the other thing I want to bring up also is just the way Little B and her son Charlie interact.
Batman.
And the beauty of, you know, in a way, Sarah also learns a lesson from that that I think ultimately does connect to the political issues as well, because it allows her to see Little B, you know, really with a completely human face, you know, not a generic refugee, but as someone who has a magic touch with her son.
And it also, in the end, works quite the other way, in that Little B recognizes that little Charlie, who is forever dressed in his Batman suit, that her soul is connected to his dial.
Right. I mean, I think that's one of the most powerful themes in the book, this sense of interconnectedness as seen in very, very close focus. There are about five characters in the book, and yet these sort of massive international forces, political and otherwise, are swirling around them. And I think it's very well executed on the part of Cleave. And returning to the theme of journalism, Sarah is a journalist. Andrew, her husband, who kills himself, is a journalist. In a sense, Little B is sort of a journalist. The book we're reading is one part of the story, one way of describing what has happened. And Cleave himself, as the author, works as a journalist. And so the question is, how can you amplify a story? How can you make the story relatable? And within the text, there is a conversation about how, you know, Sarah wants to write a book about this, and maybe she should just, you know, quit her job at the magazine and do that. And I think the question of representation is one that would be good for everyone to sort of consider. You know, what are the ways that we listen or do not listen? What are the stories that are available to us? And what kind of, and I almost think this book is more effective because it has characters that are sort of cosmopolitan, relatable, dealing with things that might otherwise go unnoticed.
Dio, I'd be interested in your own background. I know you were born in this country. When did your parents come here from Nigeria?
My parents went to medical school in Nigeria and came here in 1983 to do their residencies and fellowships in Chicago, actually. And they always thought that they were going back. However, in 1984, there was a military coup in Nigeria of the kind that had persisted since 1960, when Nigeria became a country. And so they stayed because it was too dangerous to go back for them, and there weren't as many opportunities. And I think that that's probably a pretty timeless story, I think, for a lot of 20th century migrants to the United States and to other countries. And again, there's a whole literature of this. If anyone is interested in further reading, I think the work of Carol Phillips, who's a British author, the work of Sam Selvon, whose book The Lonely Londoners is a very good early version of this sort of story of existing in a new space. But even now, I think what's going on in Nigeria with the president underscores the way that, you know, politics in other faraway places can really come home and make a difference in Western lives.
Do you agree?
Yeah, and what struck me about the book is precise. I mean, I don't know, Dio, how you felt about it. Seemed to me Nigeria was in a way a bit of a backdrop, in the sense of it was Nigeria, but could it have been the Congo? Could it have been Liberia? Could it have been Sudan? Could it have been another? I mean, from someone who, you know, travels to Africa on humanitarian missions, what struck me wasn't the texture around Nigeria. It was more Nigeria almost as generic African country in distress. And the other thing that strikes me is that, again, just being very honest here, I mean, Nigeria is not a country that I tend to think about as being in the midst of political turmoil, political chaos that drives refugees, that drives asylum seekers. I mean, I think of Congo, Somalia, Sudan in Africa first and foremost. So the idea that Nigeria is producing the seventh largest number of asylum seekers in the world, when I looked that up after reading the book, I mean, that really hit home. I mean, here's a country that's clearly in crisis that we're not paying enough attention to.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Diane. Well, I do think that, again, it's the oil. I mean, it's not, there is a conflict, but it is about something that powers civilization. And so that is the thing that sort of connects what's going on in Nigeria to what's going on in Britain or anywhere else in the West.
Lisa, I'd be interested in your reaction to Sarah's lover.
Her lover, Lawrence. You know, it's interesting to me. I had trouble with this part of the book because I thought that I found her very sympathetic. I enjoyed her, and yet I struggled with the fact that she had this lover and that her husband committed suicide. It made sense to me that her husband was so devastated by what happened on the beach and his failure to rise to the occasion.
He couldn't get over it,
and she could. She had acted. She had made a difference. But I found the men in this story, frankly, we were talking earlier, missing. The men were missing in a funny kind of way.
Except those with the guns.
Exactly. Those soldiers. I almost could not read that section of the book. I was shaking so hard on the beach as those soldiers chased those two little girls. And there were other parts in the book like that as well. But the Andrew and Lawrence, the husband and the lover, were not multidimensional to me.
Do you agree?
I agree. And Lisa and I were talking about this before the show began, and it is ironic. I mean, you have a male doing a narrative, you know, with two in the voice of not one, but two
women,
you know, who are completely different. And then the men in the book are either the thugs with guns or, in essence, these ciphers. So, it's
cipher
sort of an ironic way to look at it.
Joel Charney, he's vice president for policy at Refugees International. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got some callers who'd like to join the conversation. 800-433-8850. First to Randy, who's in Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I didn't see Sarah as someone who was in any way noble or who made a wonderful sacrifice. To me, she was a person who sowed ruin everywhere. She destroyed everything she touched, and it seemed to me that all of her predicaments were a byproduct of bad decision-making. So if there was any take-home message for me, it was that. I, too, like one of your panelists said, I was disturbed that she was cheating on her husband. I was disturbed that she was lying to everyone. These were all choices she made. She dragged her husband to Nigeria when he didn't want to go. Then she insisted on taking him outside the safety of the hotel compound despite warnings. And then when they saw the soldiers way down at the end of the beach, they didn't run. So all of these decisions she made, and eventually her husband was so devastated from depression that he killed himself, and I felt she was very much to blame for putting him in that position. If you remember in the book, the only reason he went is he was trying desperately to save his marriage because he had discovered the affair. And then in addition to being a bad wife, I thought she was a terribly neglectful mother with a very out-of-control kid. And then she made another series of bad decisions, again on a beach. I thought it was interesting that both times that Little B had became a sacrificial lamb, in essence, it happened on a beach, once in Nigeria and the second time on the beach in London. And they sent her up to talk to the police when the little boy went missing. So a second time she was implicated in Little B's demise. And Little B ended up back in Nigeria, a place where she was really going to have no real opportunities in life and maybe not even be safe.
You know, I want to just talk about one thing, and that is Charlie. I didn't see Charlie as out of control. I saw Sarah as an indulgent mother who said, okay, Charlie, you want to wear the Batman costume, it's okay with me.
Yeah, I feel that way too. I also think that Sarah is constantly being contrasted with Little B, and her privilege is very loud. Her problems with her lover, her problems with her job, again, are always, in comparison to Little B, very small. But I did not see her as an antagonist, as a villain in this story. I thought that she was very sympathetic. I did not blame her for her husband's suicide.
And poor Charlie, let's face it, is dealing with a marriage on the rocks initially, and then his father's suicide. So I think one would be rather indulgent under those circumstances.
Joel Turney, Lisa Page, Dio Olapade. We'll take a short break and be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Tarcher Penguin, with Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, in stores and online. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
You are a violent man, my friend.
After starring in the series The Shield, Walton Goggins is starring in Justified as a white supremacist who now claims to be born again and preaches to the federal marshal pursuing him.
At one moment, you could be breaking into the home of a fugitive. In the very next moment, you could be facing your final judgment.
Walton Goggins on The Next Fresh Air.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the book Little Bee. It's our reader's review for this month, written by British author Chris Cleave. It became a New York Times bestseller. It's now out in paperback. Here in the studio, Lisa Page. She's a freelance writer, creative writing teacher at George Washington University. Joel Charney. He's vice president for policy at Refugees International. And Dio Olapade is Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation. She's a political reporter for the Daily Beast. We'll go back to the phones now to Indianapolis. Good morning, Angie. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you very much for having me this morning.
Certainly.
I loved this book and sort of took a leap of faith in reading it. I kind of like to know what I'm getting into. And the jacket description on the book I read said, two women meet on a beach. Both of their lives are changed. You're going to have to trust us that you should read this book. So I did. And what hooked me right away was Little B in the detention center telling her story. And one of the first things she said was, we're going to need to agree that this story has a happy ending because I'm here to tell it. I am going to tell you some very sad things that happen, but the good story is that I'm here. And there was something about that that broke my heart that I thought was beautifully written. And I do think that ultimately this was a story of hope, that she was able to redeem Sarah in a way, and that she was able to bring some understanding really to the greater world about what was going on by the fact that Sarah was a journalist, and also by the fact that really she saved little Charlie Batman when she chose to expose herself to the guards toward the end.
Dio.
You know, I think there's a very strong tension in this book between the voice narrating the events that we're hearing about and the actions that we're hearing about. And so I think it can be easy to sort of take from the way the story is being told, as you've described it, and the things that are going on. I think, you know, at the same time that Little B is incredibly precocious and funny and talks about being in England, you know, how could I explain to the girls back home what a table made of coffee could be? She's also, you know, exhibiting extremely post-traumatic behavior, which is trying to find ways to kill herself in the most odd of places, constantly sort of fearing that the men are coming, the men they come and, as a narrative trope. And so I think... I wouldn't call it a hopeful story. I would call it an extraordinarily descriptive and informative one, down to the level of the voice carrying the message of this particular story and the enormous international story behind it. But I do think, you know, it's obviously enormously enjoyable to read for that reason, but we have to remember what's being discussed.
One email says the main English character, Sarah, doesn't know she's made a difference until Little B shows up on her doorstep. She's able to move on because at least she tried, but she doesn't know it worked until Little B comes. And then there's another email which says, the story of the husband who commits suicide reminds me of the true story of photographer Kevin Carter, who killed himself after much criticism of a photograph he took of a starving little girl in Africa without helping her. Dio, do you remember
that? Yeah, I know
that
photo very well. It won a Pulitzer Prize. And the question is, why are you photographing? Is this pornography to photograph a child who's on the brink of death by starvation, rather than taking the child in your arms and finding it food? And I think that's a very important tension that journalists should deal with, and that this story treats in a very subtle way.
And here's a message on Facebook from Chaya, who says, we have a sign on the door to our country that says, give us your tired, poor, huddled masses yearning to breathe free. If we cannot do that, we need to take the sign down. Lisa?
Well, this book opens up with the quote, Britain is proud of its tradition of providing a safe haven for people fleeing persecution and conflict. Similar, and this is from Life in the United Kingdom, A Journey to Citizenship Provided at Detention Centers. It's a great concept. But is it actually put into action? I mean, do you really see these things happen for refugees?
Let's go back to the phones to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Connie.
Good morning. I'm hoping the panel can help me remember. There was one soldier on the beach that was very well educated, and that's the character that I just struggle with. I can't understand his motivation for being... He was just the most heinous soldier, and he was the leader, but I don't get his character, and I thought it was so well written, but I'm hoping you can help me remember A, his name, or if they even provide a name, and B, what your thoughts were about him, if you recall what I'm talking about, and I'll take my
now
time.
Is he the one with the wound on his neck?
My recollection is he's not named. And I think the dynamic there is the military is a vehicle to power in many of these countries, and elite education, or at least a, you know, a university education, and then seeing the military as a way to power is something that's fairly common. So the disconnect between the idea that he's articulate or educated and the idea that he can commit these events, I mean, you know, that that's a universal phenomenon.
And also one a particular consequence of the difficulty in transferring power in Nigeria this last year and a half has been that under the acting president, money that was supposed to be sent to the Niger Delta for reintegration and rehabilitation and education for a lot of these young people in these militias stopped. And so you saw a flare in violence after the policies that had been supposed to integrate folks back from their lives as soldiers into the community, that all was disrupted, and you saw a spike in violence afterward.
All right, to Debbie in Sexton's River, Vermont. Let's see if I can get this. Debbie, are you there?
I am here.
Good morning.
From Vermont.
Good morning.
I just wanted to reiterate that I also love this book, and I've recommended it to many other people in my neighborhood. I was just wanted to comment on how when I was the author was able to make me read the narrative in the accents of each character. You know, there was an Asian woman, there was a Caribbean woman, the character with the British accent. I don't think I've ever read a book where I myself, in my, you know, in my mind, I don't know if I'm explaining myself correctly, but use the colloquial language and was mimicking the dialect, you know, the accent. I kind of had fun with that and thought each character really stood alone because of that.
Lisa.
Yeah, I think Cleve has said in an interview that he researched each dialect, including his own child's dialect for Charlie's language, the voice of a four-year-old, by just spending a whole lot of time with him to get it right. I mean, he went to some trouble to get the idioms.
He talked about, little Charlie talked about the baddies and the goodies.
The baddies and the goodies, yes. And his that character of Charlie is so metaphorical to this book because he's struggling. He's trying to fight the baddies and protect the goodies.
Here's an email from Morag, who says, I'm halfway through reading this book and am enthralled. It's hard to put it down. As a British woman who's also the mother of a four-year-old, though mine is a princess, not a Batman, I find the parts dealing with Charlie ring so true. Thank you for today's program. How did you find the character of Charlie?
Well, it was interesting to see the sort of stages of maturity between Charlie, Little B, and Sarah. And at times, all three were incredibly immature. At times, each individual exhibited a certain amount of strength and resilience that would be unexpected for their age. And I thought, again, the interactions between Little B and Charlie, particularly when he finally realizes that his father is gone and he leaps into the grave. And it is Little B who is there. And I think going back to the critique of Sarah from one of the earlier callers, I think to a certain extent she was so dissociated from what was going on that she couldn't help. But Little B, hours into their relationship, goes down into the grave to help Charlie. And I think that triangle between the three of them is a really good way of sort of exhibiting how people deal with trauma differently.
There's also the last scene in which Charlie finally takes off his Batman outfit. Why does he do that?
Well, Little B told him she would tell him her real name if he would take it off. And she had taken the name of Little B when they were trying to escape the soldiers, as her sister had also taken another name. And then she reveals her name, which translates to peace. It's very moving scene.
Very symbolic, I think, when he finally takes off his Batman uniform, revealing this little blonde head and white skin on this beach. How did you see it symbolically, Dio?
Well, I don't want to spoil too much of the story for those who haven't finished the novel. But it's a very ambiguous ending, recapitulating the themes of sacrifice and the stakes could not be higher, I think, at the end of the book, given what we know about the characters and how much we've related to them. And Charlie, I mean, I think the revelation of the name is a sense of sort of, I don't want to call it giving up, but it's been something, the one thing that Little Bee had to protect. Not even herself necessarily. You know, she would sacrifice her body for Charlie, for Sarah. She did it in London when she sacrificed herself by going to the police. But all she had left was her name that she was guarding, and she gives it up. And I think that symbolically, I'm not sure what that represents, but it is, again, without going too much into the plot, it's something that is very meaningful at the moment.
And what struck me is just, again, the image of Charlie finally taking off his Batman costume. And there he is, I think, knowing that kind of lives are at risk, or it's clearly there's something at stake if Little B was willing to
he knows.
But yet then the next image is with him frolicking with African children on the beach, a sort of iconic it's all going to be okay kind of image. And you know, when Dio refers to the tension at the end, that's part of the tension.
And that tension is just so great. It was hard to put that book down. Like all of our callers, I too have loved this book. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Rockville, Maryland. Deborah, sorry, it's Deba. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. This is Deepa with a P. Love your show.
Thank you.
Read the book and loved it. Absolutely. It awakened so many emotions and provided so many thoughts for reflection that, you know, the book stayed on much longer beyond what I had imagined. I just wanted to point out what came across to me very starkly was this message of how we value lives differently. And as I was reading that book, strangely I was drawn to a writer by another British journalist called Jeremy Seabrook, who wrote a couple of days after the famous 9/11 incident, and he wrote of how this boat capsized, a small boat capsized in Dhaka, Bangladesh, killing more than double the amount of people who were killed in 9/11. And he writes poignantly about the fact that how, you know, these lives had so little mention in any media. And it just sort of brought home this message that how we classify people, you know, the whole immigrant situation as well, I think, you know, the alien immigrants and the non sort of legal immigrants, and how you know, put people into these brackets, and how you miss out on the humanness of experiences that people go through. And it just was a remarkable read for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Deepa.
I mean, this is something I've struggled with my whole career. I mean, why do some lives at stake capture people's imagination, whether it's a girl in a well or, you know, the victims of 9/11, whereas other lives we act as if they have no value? And, you know, from a humanitarian perspective, how do we mobilize people around particular crises that are completely ignored? And this is the challenge that we're facing constantly.
Joel Charney, he's at Refugees International. Lisa Page at George Washington University. Dio Olapade, she is a fellow at the New America Foundation, political reporter for The Daily Beast. The book we've been talking about, Little Bee, by Chris Cleave. And I especially want to thank former producer Elizabeth Terry for recommending that we choose this book for this month. Thank you all for being here. Let me tell you that to mark the 50th anniversary of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, that will be our book for next month. So I hope you'll join us on June 16th and start reading now again. That's Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Thank you all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.